This is common ground. The 2,000-mile-long border shared by the United States and Mexico is unlike any other place in America. Known in Spanish as La Frontera, this border region is sometimes looked upon as a separate nation, erasing other artificial political boundaries.
On the border, I think women's situations are being affected in a lot of ways. There has been a flow back and forth of people just in our daily living out of our lives for a long, long time. There's an interdependence because two cities, two countries literally overlap here. If you see it from the air, you can see how this border is really an artificial line, an artificial divider. We share families, we share culture, we share all kinds of things in economies.
Along La Frontera, you'll find some of the poorest communities in the United States, and among the poorest of the poor are women. On the next two episodes of Common Ground, we'll explore the lives of women on the border, the unique problems of immigrants newly arrived in the U.S., and, for some, long settled here. In part two, we'll learn about innovative programs women have set up to improve their lives, and how many of these ideas are being exported from the South to the North. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. The borderland in the summer is hot. Dry heat notwithstanding, the midday mouth-parching temperatures can range well above 100 degrees, sometimes over 120. And in that heat, potable water is a necessity. While most of us in the U.S. can take for granted access to fairly clean drinking water, that's not the case for thousands of people down here. Recently, on one day alone, 20 people, mostly children, in Juarez, Mexico, died from drinking contaminated water. Even on the U.S. side of this border community, access to water is a problem for many people. Sister Mary Beth Larkin is a community activist and an organizer in El Paso, Texas.
At the present time, there are approximately 75,000 El Paso residents who live in colonias, neighborhoods which don't have running water and sewer systems, as well as many other of the basic services that we consider part of the standard of living in the United States in terms of neighborhoods.
How did these poor neighborhoods, which don't have running water or proper sanitation, develop?
It's certainly not the American way, if there is such a thing, but what has occurred in El Paso is over, and this is not a phenomenon that is restricted to El Paso. All along the border, and particularly in the state of Texas, between here and Brownsville, there are somewhere around 300,000 families or people who live in colonia-type neighborhoods without basic infrastructure. And what's occurred is that as the population has grown, the cities have not kept up with the need for affordable housing in order to be able for people to be able to live, you know, in decent housing developed within the city limits or within places where infrastructure is available. Developers who were aware of the market of low-income people and unscrupulous in terms of not wanting to follow the usual standards and provide the infrastructure as they develop their areas, they purchased land which was formerly farmland or in many cases just desert land, undeveloped raw desert land, and they cut it up crudely into small lots. The typical colonial lot size is somewhere between a quarter and a half of an acre, and they sold it off to families and told them, as you move in here and as the place kind of fills in, then the infrastructure will be forthcoming. But of course they knew that they were not going to provide it, and the way the system works in the United States, there wasn't anybody there to provide it, and so they were really selling people a bill of goods.
On the outskirts of El Paso is a neighborhood called Sparks, where some 500 families live. Gusts of wind swirl the dust from some of the still unpaved, unnamed streets in the 20-year-old colonia. 18 years ago, Anastasia Ledesma and her husband decided to move from their poor neighborhood in El Paso out to Sparks, where they could own their own home.
Aquí nunca ha habido servicios. Nosotros fuimos los primeros que empezamos a
She says there was nothing here when they bought the property, no water, no nothing, and they were the ones that started working to see what they could get, and the first thing that they got was the phone, the telephone.
Con la electricidad,
they didn't have electricity for several years, and they had to use kerosene lamps to light the house. In 1981, they started working to bring electricity, and some of the people here in the community got electricity, but she didn't.
What did you do for water? I mean, what have you done for water up until now?
Bueno, cuando nosotros éramos todavía, como quien dice, huérfanos.
When they first moved here, and they say that when they were, she says that when they were still orphans, they went to the city water company, and they thought it was going to be really easy to get the water, but they were told that it would be impossible to get water here, that it was too far.
The Ledesmas built this house themselves, just like most people in Sparks. Next to the small front room is the dining room, and between the table and a small curio cabinet filled with family mementos is a huge blue 50-gallon drum which holds the Ledesma's water supply.
La traemos este día. Este día en la mañana la trajimos y luego de aquí la estoy hirviendo.
They bring the water this morning, and they keep this supply here so that they have it as they sit at the table and eat. She also has some in the refrigerator, so they'll have some that's cold. And then she has some on the stove, which they use to heat for bathing and cooking and stuff. But the water supply, they have to bring in here every couple of days. And at this point, they bring it in by truck in several of these 50-gallon drums and then pass it from the outside barrels into the house.
Is that a county program that brings the water
out
here?
No, her family has to go get it. There is a private company that will truck water to people. It's $35 a load. And if you need a load every week, that's over $100 a month. That's a lot of money. And that's more than most of the families in this area would be able to afford. And, you know, depending on the size of the family and the number of people in the household, that determines the number of trips you have to make to go get water and bring it back.
Now, this 50-gallon drum, how long will it last you, and what all will you use it for? Is it for cooking and drinking and bathing?
Bueno, hasta el martes nada más. Sí, nada más para tomar, para cocinar y para enjuagar los trastes.
Okay, she uses it for drinking, for cooking, and to wash the dishes with. She said this will last until Tuesday, and then they'll have to go for another load.
So this is Friday, so that's about a 4-day supply.
Mm-hmm.
After 18 years of waiting, the Ledesmas will soon have running water. With the help of the El Paso Interreligious Sponsoring Organization, known as APISO and headed by Sister Mary Beth Larkin, the people of Sparks have organized and brought the first water tower to their community.
Es que yo siento todavía como sueño.
She says that it's still like
Porque
a dream.
Años de lucha.
She says that after so many years of hard work in trying to get the water here, that, you know, that's why she feels like it's a dream. That it's been many meetings, many reporters coming here and interviewing, and very hard work, and that she always had hope, and that's why she never gave up.
The Ledesmas have put up with more than most Americans would ever tolerate, but some newcomers to this country would find even life in Sparks to be an improvement. Here in the foyer of Annunciation House in downtown El Paso, a half dozen young men pass the time on cast-off furniture, talking quietly and trying to stay cool in the sweltering heat. Many of them have been attracted here by the hope of finding work in the maquiladoras, the factories that have sprung up all along the Mexico side of the border. Annunciation House is one of five houses operating in El Paso and Juarez since 1978. They provide some shelter and guidance for newly arrived immigrants and refugees who have nowhere else to go. Ruben Garcia is the director of Annunciation House.
Over the years, there's always been an evolution of the kinds of people that we see here. There have been times here at Annunciation House where we have seen so many Central Americans that we literally closed the houses off to anybody other than Central Americans. And sometimes there were so many Central Americans that we had to prioritize from among the Central Americans, where we basically said we will only respond to those Central Americans who have got a kind of a prima facie case for political asylum.
Currently, what is the situation with your clientele? Are you at capacity, or has it been reduced greatly?
Here at Annunciation House, it's been pretty full. You know, in September of 93, they implemented this border blockade, or what is referred to as the border blockade, and really it was a change in the way that Border Patrol does its border surveillance. Initially, that had an impact in the numbers of people that we saw here at the house. Since then, little by little, people have found ways to compensate for the blockade.
Do you find that women face any particular hurdles in getting established, either in the U.S. or over in Juarez?
We've heard an awful lot of stories from people who have spoken about the difficulty that is now involved in trying to migrate through Mexico. You know, Mexico has increased its own surveillance of its southern border. It has stepped up its immigration checkpoints. And also, because of the movement of people, Mexican as well as non-Mexican, there's been a significant increase in the numbers of people who prey on immigrants, on people on the move, on refugees. And this is from the very moment that you enter through Mexico, all through Mexico, up to the very border right here, you know, is where people attempting to cross. One of the things that they have to do is run the risk of bumping into someone who's got a knife or a gun. We've had many women who have spoken about being robbed, about being mistreated, about being raped, as we have also heard of men being beaten, being killed. In addition to that is the difficulty that women encounter in trying to find a situation that is going to be secure and viable for themselves, especially if any children are involved. And this, in the majority of cases, when children are involved, they're going to be in the care of women. And this places them in an extremely vulnerable type of situation. For those that cross into the United States, there's probably an advantage in being female, in the sense that live-in housework is a type of employment that lends itself a lot more to people who are undocumented. For example, you may have here at Annunciation House, you can have 30 women enter the shelter, and I would say that in a matter of weeks, all 30 of them would be working in somebody's home. They would receive a wage, they'd have a place to live, usually there's meals, etc. Whereas you bring in 30 men, and you try and find work for them, and it is very, very difficult for them to find work.
Are there government assistance programs for people in the same situation as those you work with?
We've been raided. Six, seven of us have been arrested. I have our cars confiscated. their type of assistance is an assistance we can do without. You know, people will say to me, you know, what's your relationship with Border Patrol? And I say, it's schizophrenic. I said, but I can tell you of instances. The room that you were sitting in right now, as you come in the door, to the right, there's a window that's by the parking lot. And all of a sudden, this was in November, it was cold outside, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and I'm talking to somebody, and all of a sudden, on the window, I hear, and I look up, and I said, good God, that looks like a Border Patrol agent. So I go out the door, and I go out to the parking lot, and there, hugging the building, is this huge Border Patrol van. And I say to him, can I help you? And he says, look, We've just picked up this group of women. They're all from Honduras. We have no space to lock them up anyplace. They've got some small babies. One of those babies is sick. We're going to turn them loose. I just can't turn them loose out on the street. That baby is sick. Will you guys take them in? And we said, of course we will. And there was like 7, 8 women with their small children. So obviously that Border Patrol agent was really concerned that, you know, if someone finds out that I'm bringing people to Annunciation House, you know, they're going to say something to me. My point is, these are human beings. Whether they should or shouldn't be here, the fact is they are here.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Common Ground. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that encourages thought and dialogue about world affairs. For the next two programs, we're exploring the lives of the most marginalized people, especially women, on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mi nombre es Dora Elia Martínez Meras. Yo soy de Torreón, Coahuila.
I am from Torreón, Coahuila, in Mexico.
Why did you come here?
Yo tengo bastante tiempo que vine aquí cuando estaba embarazada de mi niña, la más grande.
I came when I was still pregnant with my daughter, and I came because in Mexico I am poor, and I don't have any means with which to give my daughter any kind of life. And I had heard that if I came to the United States and my daughter was born here, then she would have a right to study, to go to school here.
Are you here with any other family, parents or husband or anything?
Sí, sola.
I'm here by myself.
Is that difficult for you?
Pues es muy difícil porque tengo a mis hijas y necesito
It is very hard, but I have no choice. I have to, and I'm willing to do any kind of work that's necessary in order for me to be able to raise my daughters. I was very, very poor, and I want to make sure that my daughters have what I was not able to have. I basically have raised myself for most of my life. And I don't care what shame or what work it is that I have to do. I'm willing to ask people if I can wash their dishes or sweep their streets or whatever in order to continue with my daughters.
We leave Ruben Garcia's office to tour the rest of Annunciation House. The men's dorm is downstairs, and upstairs are the women's and family dorms, where one young girl is busy sweeping the hallway.
Over here is the family section, and they're all small little rooms like that, and we'll put a family in each one of the small rooms. They're very, very small. They're very, very crowded, but that's all that we got, you know. ¡Qué bien, Barres! ¿Estás ayudando a tu mama? And so if the family unit is together, we let the papa stay here as well. And so some of the families are a complete unit, but more often than not, it's a woman with kids.
Just a few blocks away from Annunciation House in downtown El Paso are the offices of Las Americas Refugee Asylum Project. Headed by Delia Gomez, LARAP, as it's called, was created in 1987 to deal with the ever-increasing number of refugees turning up at places like Annunciation House.
And at that time, in 1980, as we talked to people, that's when we realized, you know, a lot of these people are fleeing persecution. So we started educating ourselves about the situation, learned about political asylum, tried to do it on a volunteer basis and trying to find attorneys to take a case when it was needed, but we realized that was going to be very hard. So eventually, Las Americas was established to take care of that legal need for people who couldn't afford private attorneys.
Now, U.S. policy favors granting asylum to people who fear persecution in their home country. And economic refugees are not given, or people who are fleeing very impoverished conditions are not given the same kind of consideration. What type of cases are you handling?
You're right that they have to prove what's called a well-founded fear of persecution, and it has to be on account of one of five things. It may be their race, their religion, their social group, their nationality, or their political opinion. The cases that we end up taking are very often people who have fled, more often than not, governmental persecution, but not exclusively. Sometimes we see people who are being persecuted by, say, a guerrilla group. But usually it's trade unionists. There are many, many things that may seem innocent that can get you in trouble in places like Guatemala. We have seen people who were simply literacy workers who were teaching the poor to read. And that is seen as a threat. It's seen as organizing. And so anything that is seen as a threat to the status quo or to the government line, you can be persecuted for. We have seen people who have had family members disappear, who they themselves have been arrested, imprisoned, beaten, tortured, and so on.
Is that your criteria for accepting a case here, that they have a well-founded fear of persecution?
We have to go by what the law says asylum is. And in fact, we turn away sometimes people who have a basis for asylum, but because we may have such a backlog and we're so overwhelmed, we have to do a triage sort of system and say we'll take those that seem to be in the most danger if returned. And so our criteria sometimes will vary depending on what's happening in a particular country. If the danger is greater for Guatemalans at this point than it is for, say, Nicaraguans, then we will have a priority in that way. We also have some special considerations for women, minors, the elderly, because they may have less options open to them, and so that if returned, they face special danger sometimes, or they have, but there has to be some basis for asylum that we can use.
You mentioned that women who are turned away from the U.S. sometimes face a different kind of persecution back home. In what ways?
Many women will have asylum claims very similar to those of men. They participated in a strike, they tried to organize women workers or something, and were targeted. The consequences for women sometimes are different. Rape, of course, is something that's used as a form of persecution and to instill fear in a large group of women very, very commonly. The problems that women face also include things like they are not as mobile. They can't hide as easily because they usually have children. As far as the journey, once they get out of the country, it's a long, arduous journey and a very dangerous one. And if you're a woman, the dangers multiply. Again, rape, we've heard just story after story after story about when they were arrested in Mexico by the Mexican immigration. They were first extorted. They were forced to turn over all their possessions and so on, and then raped. And sometimes deported anyway, sometimes threatened with further abuse if they did not submit to sexual favors, sometimes let go after that. And the dangers multiply and multiply, and women sometimes become more vulnerable, first of all because of the sexual attacks, again because they may have children and they cannot hide as easily. They have to also look out for the lives of the little ones and so on.
What happens to the children?
Pardon me?
What happens to the children? I mean,
what happens to the children?
Are they bothered much?
There are times when the children are left alone. There are other times when they're used as a threat against the women. Say, if you don't want your child hurt, you better go along with what I want. There are times when the children themselves have been abused. And or even just, for instance, I remember one case where a whole family was traveling together with coyotes, and they had them hidden in the back of a fruit truckload of fruit. And there was only standing room only. And this was all the way through Mexico. By the time they got here, they were dehydrated. Some of them had not eaten. The children were sick. And they were being held in a hotel by the coyote until they got money from relatives to let them go. And the way they did it is they charged, I think, $1,000 per head. And as soon as they were able to come up with $1,000, the one they would release was the youngest child. And so, of course, the child couldn't go on their own, so they still had the whole family. So this was on top of all the abuse they had already suffered and the obstacles they had overcome just to get out of their country.
Gender oppression is one of the newest categories for asylum claims. These cases may be based on rape in the home country, or in some parts of the world, such practices as genital mutilation or bride burning. But even if a persecuted woman makes it to the U.S., says Delia Gomez, immigrant women may still be abused, even by those closest to them.
The issue of domestic violence is something that we see here in this country quite a bit, that's used against not just refugee women, but immigrant women as a way to keep them, so to speak, in their place by men. For instance, we have had cases where a couple comes up, maybe with children, a family comes up. Both may have a valid fear of persecution because of their activities. However, because of the man's ability to be more visible in their country, more politically involved, and more mobile, he may be the one with the strongest case. If they're traveling together, if they're a common law marriage, we can use, or a marriage, we can use the claim of one spouse and include the other spouse in it. So we will normally take the strongest case. Very often we've seen cases where once they're here and they're being processed for asylum, the man may start abusing his wife and beating her and so on, and use the fact that he has the claim to keep the woman from leaving. And in those cases, when we become aware of it, we really have to counsel the woman and say, you know, you can seek asylum on your own. The consequences, though, are often it's a harder case to prove, we don't have as much evidence and so on, even though the dangers may be the same if returned. So it's going to be a case that's harder to present to the courts and win.
So these immigrant women may in fact face a double persecution, both from outside forces and within their own family. In part two of our series about women on the U.S.-Mexico border, we'll look at what women are doing for themselves to improve their lives and how they're reaching across borders to help each other. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a transcript or audio cassette of this Common Ground program, contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-825-5746. And ask for program number 9436. Individual programs cost $9.95 plus shipping and handling. The two-part series is $15.95 plus shipping and handling. Again, the toll-free number to order transcripts or tapes is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.